Good morning, everyone. So my name is Bob Rosenbaum. My Dharma name is Meikyo Onzen, or Onza, which means clear mirror, calm sitting, or calm Zen. And lineage started sitting 50 years ago or so with Choshu Sasaki Roshi, a Rinzai teacher. Went to Japan, sat with Omori Roshi, another Rinzai teacher, got disillusioned with Zen. Had many years in the wilderness, found my way to Berkeley Zen Center, where I studied with my root teacher, Sojourn Mel Weitzman. So Soto's really in my bones and my home. But for various reasons, over these last few years, I've gotten involved with Ordinary Mind Zen and received Denkai in that lineage from Karen Terzano. But my other teacher and other lineage, which is co-equal with the Zen lineage for me, is Master Wei Liu in the lineage of Grandmaster Yang Mei Jun in Dayan Qigong, Wild Goose Qigong, which some of you might know Jiyu Kennett practiced that as well. And I'll probably refer to some Taoist aspects as well in this talk. But the talk is basically about the Surangama Sutra. And I did write a book recently. I did not bring books with me to sell because I'm not good at that sort of thing. But the book is called That Is Not Your Mind. The Surangama Sutra is not well known in our lineages. It's central to Chinese Chan. The Japanese lineages said, well, it's probably apocryphal. And it probably is, but there's lots of apocryphal sutras which have a lot of wisdom in them. And so I rather fell in love with the sutra, and I wrote the book because I would like to encourage people to investigate the sutra. So let me start by saying, so this comes from the Surangama Sutra. What's this? Well, you probably have various ideas, but basically, this is us. And it's all knotted up. And the Surangama Sutra says, all living beings are all knotted up. And how do we realize our true selves? So the Buddha at one point in the sutra holds up a cloth and he says, well, you know, to undo the knots doesn't work to pull on the ends like this, and it doesn't work to pull on this end. How do you undo a knot? Well, you undo it from the center, and the center's empty. If the center weren't empty, you could never undo it. And you undo it, and you undo it, and pretty soon, and you encounter difficulties along the way, and you find your life's a whole cloth. Well, how do we do that? When you looked at this originally, and we could keep on undoing it, right? Unwinding each thread, but then I wouldn't be able to wrap it around my neck to warm myself. So when you first looked at it, did you see the scarf? Maybe yes, maybe not. So the Surangama scripture says at one point, when I don't see, why don't you see my not seeing? If you see my not seeing, that's not it, because it's obviously not the characteristic of not seeing. You're seeing, but there's not seeing. Doesn't work. But if you don't see my not seeing, it's naturally not a thing. How could it not be you? So that's a koan in the Book of Serenity. And it was my first introduction to the Surangama Sutra. And for some reason, that one really caught me. And I kept coming back to it again and again until I had time to delve into the sutra. And basically, the Surangama Sutra is another Dharma gate to realizing no thing exists. It's really that simple. And yet, our life is amongst things. So everything is an illusion, but that doesn't make it unreal. Well, that kind of makes sense, but where are we with that? And as I get a little further into the sutra, I'm going to take you on a kind of whirlwind tour of it. And there's probably going to be a number of places where you go, what is he talking about? What is this sutra? All this Zen nonsense. And there's actually many places in the sutra where Buddha's listeners go, I don't understand. It's one of the reasons I love the sutra. At one point, one person, one of his wise listeners says, I don't understand. I might as well be a deaf man trying to hear a mosquito from a distance of 100 paces. It's one of the reasons I love the sutra. It's got a lot of humor to it, as well as a lot of esoterica. So in response to I don't understand, the Buddha says, oh, still trying to understand, huh? An enlightenment to which an understanding is added cannot be a true enlightenment, because you had to add something to it. On the other hand, an enlightenment that lacks understanding cannot be true intrinsic enlightenment. Don't worry about understanding or not understanding. The Buddha says, once the category of something understood is mistakenly established in the mind, the category that which understands is mistakenly established as well. Oh, as soon as you say, I understand it, you don't. Because you've separated yourself. You've tied a knot in the scarf. So the Surangama Sutra, to do a quick summary. So everything's an illusion, no things exist, but don't get caught don't get caught on existing and not existing. There's no is and no is not. There's simply the matrix of the thus come one, the matrix of suchness. Well, what's suchness? The Lankavatara Sutra says, I love this definition. Oh, suchness is simply the mind set free. Whenever you experience genuine freedom and liberation, which can be happening every moment, that suchness that's realized Buddha mind. So this is part of the Yogacara school of mind only, but let's not get hung up on that. So nothing exists, nothing does not exist. But karma is relentless. So we need to establish a place for awakening. And then we have these various practices. And there's a point in the Sarangama Sutra where 25 sages describe how each of them realized enlightenment. But basically, it all comes down to whatever practice you're doing, don't do that practice. Go to the enlightened basis of that practice. Now, I said that to a friend of mine once, a Dharma-transmitted Zen teacher. Said, just go to the enlightened basis of that practice. And she said, well, yeah, how do you do that? That's our practice. When you're sitting, let the sitting sit. When you're puzzled, let the puzzlement bring forth light. And while you do all of this stuff, you're going to have a lot of different experiences. And in many of them, according to the Sarangama Sutra, demons will assail you. You'll get magical powers. You'll be able to pull worms out of your body without hurting yourself or the worms. So this is why you should practice, right? This is what we all want to do. Every thought's a worm. Every opinion's a worm. Every feeling, every sensation. No things exist, no thoughts, no sensations. We chanted the Heart Sutra, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, and yet here they are. So you'll have all of these weird experiences like getting into a car and turning it on and it goes. Weird experiences like sitting on a cushion and you don't fly off into space. Ooh. Weird experiences like having more cells in your body with non-human DNA than with human DNA, so that you're just a heap. And yet here you are. I mean, that's true biologically, right? So in the midst of all these weird experiences, and some of them are very pleasant, and you think, wow, I've got it. Yeah. The Buddha says, you'll be okay as long as you don't think you're a sage. Good advice. Boy, I really wanted to be a sage. Oh, well. Oh, well. Maybe many lifetimes from now. So, the sutra starts with an illusion where Ananda is going on his begging rounds and he's enthralled with a courtesan, and the woman, the Matanga woman, and Ananda start to take off all their clothing and they're about to have sex and they're hot and heavy with it. And the Buddha, this is another reason I like the sutra. I mean, how many sutras start with sex? But the Buddha perceives this through his magical powers and manifests the Sarangama Sutra through his skull and sends the sutra with Manjushri and rescues the Matanga woman and Ananda, and they both get there. And both are transported back to the grove. And Ananda's going, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. How could I have done that? And the Buddha doesn't get into bad Ananda. He says, Ananda, you started doing this because you were taken in by illusion. You thought, wow, this is She's there and I'm here and this feels really good. And let's get to the basis of illusion. Why'd you get into this practice anyway? Paraphrasing now. And Ananda says, I saw the Buddha manifesting the 32 marks of enlightenment, and I was dazzled. He says, well, you were dazzled by the Matanga woman, too. So, how did you get dazzled? What was it that got dazzled? And Ananda says, well, I saw the 32 marks of enlightenment, and I delighted in them and loved them with my mind and eyes. To which the Buddha says, it is the fault of your mind and eyes that you are bound to the circle of birth and death. Ooh. We don't usually think of it. It's like, oh, I've been bad, or, oh, no, I haven't followed the precepts. Actually, later in the Sarangama Sutra, there's a mantra, the same mantra with which Buddha rescued the woman and Ananda. And reciting that mantra helps your karma melt like snow. I've actually put it into the full moon ceremony, the bodhisattva ceremony, for that reason. And it says, you committed offenses against the precepts, recite this mantra, poof, gone. Go out there and commit more problems against the precepts. So the Buddha holds up his hand and he says, and he emits forth light from the hand, and he says, you see something? Ananda says, yeah. What did you see? Well, I saw you hold up a fist and light came out of it. What did you see it with? Well, I saw it with my eyes. Well, what registered what was coming in through your eyes? And Ananda says, my mind is what saw it. And it's my mind that I use to determine there's a fist, there's the light. At which point the Buddha says, Ananda, that is not your mind. Which is why I titled this book, That Is Not Your Mind. One of the most fundamental illusions is, I have a mind that sees things. That is not our mind, but the mind of the great sage of India we talk about, the Buddha mind, is us. We keep trying to understand. Good luck. Keep on trying. Good to do. What we fail to perceive is that mind understands us, which is a big relief. Big relief. So the Buddha says, Ananda, what are the two fundamentals? The first is the mind that's the basis of death and rebirth and suffering, and it's dependent on perceived objects. And that's what everyone thinks is the mind. And in my book, I call that I mind, I like ego mind. We sometimes call it small mind. And Dogen says, the mind's able to make everything its object, but that's not what Buddhas and ancestors are talking about when we're talking about Buddha mind. We sometimes talk about the importance of stemming the outflows. The outflows simply mean turning beings into objects, whether it's through ignorance, laziness, racism, habit, energy, We keep turning everything, every non-thing, into a thing, including ourselves. And it's very useful to do that. I mean, you have to do it in order to get in a car and turn it on and go on the roads. But things do not give rise to themselves, right? Things come from other something else. But if things do not give rise to themselves, what thing do they come from which didn't give rise to itself? We talk about no arising, no coming, no going. Fundamentally, the sutra says, awareness and all its conditioned objects are nothing but the pure, understanding, enlightened mind. That's not the mind. This is the mind. This mind is us. So there's no seer or anything seen, no speaker or anything spoken, merely what we imagine. Those who view such things as real, things like cups and water, they don't see the Buddha. I'm drinking Buddha now. Do that all the time. We're doing it all the time, though we don't realize it. They don't see the Buddha, nor do those who imagine nothing, only those who transform their existence. In the Lankavatara Sutra, it says, Nirvana is simply transforming karma. Don't seek some special state, just transform your karma. In other words, be kind and take that illusory lust and turn it to love. Well, how do you do that? What practice? And the sutra says, well, consider contemplating consciousness. You ever do that with your meditation? But consciousness is intermittent. It's an illusion. How could consciousness guide beings to enlightenment? No practice is entirely continuous. Even mindfulness arises and must halt, and intermittent practices' results are intermittent. How could awareness guide all beings to enlightenment? Well, that's a little shocking, isn't it? I mean, here we all are trying to be mindful and trying to be aware and trying to wake up. And I like to say, when you're tired, go to sleep. And I sometimes feel I'm at my most enlightened when I'm asleep because I'm not causing troubles to anybody else. You don't have to worry about it. And actually, one of my practices is when I wake up in the morning, I go, how did that happen? Really? Think about it. How did you wake up? You think you can make yourself wake up? Oh, boy. Well, there's an aspect of that. But let waking up wake you up. Release into it. So the Buddha says, you're doing all these practices, you've heard and practiced all these Buddhas, Buddha Dharmas, but why haven't you been hearing your own hearing? People go, what? So the Buddha says, look, you're very sincere, but you don't trust the practice. I see I'm going to have to make use of a simple example. And he turns to the Doan and he says, could you please ring the bell a little louder? Everyone hear the bell? OK. Okay, can you stop it? Now do you hear it? Everyone goes, no. Let's try again. Ring the bell, nice and loud. Okay. Hear the bell? Stop it. Hear the bell? No. One more time. You hear it? Stop it. Now do you hear it? No. To which the Buddha says, why are you giving such muddled answers? Let me just find my... And he basically says, here we are. You thought you heard the bell when it was ringing and didn't hear it when it wasn't. In that case, how did you know the sound had ceased? You had to be able to hear the sound's absence. Your true unconditioned hearing awareness includes both sound and silence and is more fundamental than sound and silence. So whenever we're practicing, we need to go and include non-practicing. That's why we do the mudra. So when you do the mudra, there's a way of holding the mudra where you place your thumbs as lightly as possible, bring them in slightly. Very important to be as light as possible. I see a lot of people whose mudras are like this, or whose mudras, you know, they sort of just like this. And if for those of you who sit with a mudra, do you ever find yourself not being aware of the mudra? And the mudra is still there, doing the meditation. So we need to be aware of our unawareness and trust it. That's different from ignorance. Okay? But it's all encompassing. Whatever you are includes and is defined by what you're not. So I'm not Chico. Not Chico helps make me what I am. And so I need to be really good to not Chico because she's me. In that knotness, this is undoing the knots, pardon the pun. So, you know, this is where things start going, there's a lot of analysis of body functions in the Surangama Sutra and of vision and of hearing. And there's no body, no mind, but we practice in body and mind, which is why the second half of the sutra is all about how to establish a place of awakening, very concrete practices of, okay, well, practice with the sense of touch, practice with the sense of hearing, practice with any one of the skandhas, thought, feeling, perceptions, formations, consciousness. Consciousness, one of it is just a skandha. Yeah. At their root, same thing. Same, not the same, not different. Practice with one dimension, hearing, touching, seeing, thinking, to get to the root of all of them. Well, how do you do that? So I was very fortunate at a point when I was really stuck in my Qigong, in my Zen practice to encounter my Qigong teacher, very unassuming woman and a true master. Like many Chinese people, she practiced Buddhism and Taoism and Confucianism, but she liked to tease me. She used to say, "Oh, you Buddhists, always talking about old age, sickness, death, suffering. We Taoists say, live a long life, be happy." I really needed that. I was really into suffering. I didn't even realize how attached I was to my suffering and how stuck I was in it, in trying to get out of it. So I learned this body practice. Very, very helpful. And when I was speaking recently, we just did a 1 day in Corvallis at Sangha Jewel. And I asked Sado, who many of you know, and Mushin, what might be helpful here. And she said, well, share with them a few of the body practices. So let me just do that briefly and then stop for questions. So in many meditations, there's three centers, right? Upper, middle, and lower. But as soon as you say that, people start thinking, oh, so something up here, and they don't find the space. So to get a sense of your upper dantian, if you place one hand on your forehead and the other hand on your occiput, just be aware of all the space in between. It's large. Place your hands on the side. So if you can kind of imagine a sphere of space and then go to the center of that sphere, that's your upper dantian. And then if you go to the middle dantian to feel your chest and your spine, go, huh, neuropsychologically, I'm a neuropsychologist and psychotherapist. We don't have many nerve endings in our viscera. So we don't have a sense of what we talked about, seeing, not seeing. This is feeling, not feeling. To just feel how much space there is between your spine and your breastbone, from rib to rib. And go to the center of that. And then on lower dantian, to go to your navel, and place your other hand on the Ming Men point, life's gate, on the spine opposite the navel. And you've heard when you meditate, go to 2 inches below the navel. There's a big misunderstanding about that. It doesn't mean below this way. It means below in. Yeah, you know, I've taught this at San Francisco Zen Center, and people went, oh, that makes sense. And it does. And then if you want to find your center, and the center, being a point, has no dimensions, right? Zero dimensions. When I first started practicing and people would say, find your center, I'd go, I can't find my center. I don't know where it is. Try this. Now that you've done upper, middle, and lower, imagine, feel your fontanelle, the byway point, where the bones knit together. And imagine there's a line going straight down from there through your brain, through the base of the brain, through your throat, not the spine, through the center of your body, through the heart and lungs, all the way down to your perineum. And there's a point between the anus and the genitals, Wuyin point. So go straight down to that. And now imagine another line going parallel to the floor through your navel out to your spine. And another line or axis going sideways this way, and the three intersect. And there you are at your center. As soon as we do that, do you feel the difference in the room? It's wonderful. Let me give you another example. So we practice with compassion, right? But people have this weird idea that compassion is a thing. And we happen to call that thing a feeling. And we think that feeling is in me. Those are all illusions. And you'll get compassion fatigue if you keep trying to create compassion. So how do you contact and become intimate with the compassion which is the mind of the great sage of India, which is the matrix of suchness? And people sometimes say, well, to feel compassion, put your hands on your heart. Well, that's a good thing to do. Try that. Just see if you summon a little feeling of, let my heart and mind open. That's good. But let's just take it a little further. As you do that, align the center of your palms with each other. So you place the centers over this center. Oh, thank you. Place the centers over the center and go in and feel the compassion there. Don't have to try, just whatever it feels like. And let yourself enjoy that. Does that feel a little different? And now let's try one other thing. Relax. Relax your arms and your hands. And then let your arms just float up and gather so that your palms align in front of you. And you're gathering compassion and gathering energy. And you look at your hands and the palms align. And now bring that energy and that compassion into yourself till you're touching, and bring it into the heart and rest in that compassion. Can you feel that? Compassion's all around us. How do we gather it? How do we rely on it? That's our practice. Ungraspable yet real. Well, the time is moving. I will say, many of you know, Dogen says, a moment arises in the mind. The mind arises in a moment. This is the understanding that the self is time. Yeah, which is kind of, whoa. The mind arises in a body. A body arises in the mind. This is the understanding that the self is space. You're just a little morsel of space and time. Here we are. So, since time by clocks is going along, I think I'll end by reading a poem I wrote a number of years ago, and somehow I keep growing into it, or it keeps growing into me. How wonderful, there's no thing to be grasped. Despite this self that, striving to let go, clutches firmer. Folding the laundry carefully, making such straight lines, I double back upon myself, a wave watching waves create a beach of footsteps, salt, and stars. Breakers never reach the shore, sloughing their crests in sprays of light, with the world moving, with the waves standing still, an old rock welcomes lichens, mosses, moons. Each strand of seaweed can only be itself. One word in conversations between tides and land, where wind becomes the ocean, disappearing into sand. That's my talk. What questions do you have?
We will have questions and comments now. If you're in the Zendo, raise your hand and I will bring you the microphone. If you're on Zoom, you can write either question or comment and you will be unmuted. Or if you'd rather have either of those things read aloud, you can type out the bulk of what you want to say and that will happen. Yeah, and if you're in the Zendo, please state your name before speaking.
Thank you for your talk. I learned a lot and I have a lot to play with now, so thank you.
Thank you, my pleasure. I love the word play. We don't do enough play. I once heard Robert Aitken Roshi give a talk and someone asked a complicated question and he kind of furrowed his brows and then he smiled the most wonderful smile and he said, "It's play, play."
Hi, I'm Zonio. I really appreciated what you said about compassion as the matrix for the matrix of mind?
Well, the matrix of the thus come one is another translation of Tathagata Garbha. Mm-hmm. So, and I really like that image of a matrix of intersections, sort of shimmering and glimmering. And speaking as a neuropsychologist, that's actually... the more we learn about biology, that's actually how our bodies and nervous systems work. It's quite remarkable.
I appreciated that. I have a pretty regular meta practice, and sometimes it feels like a little incongruent with the rest of my practice, right? Like there's a way in which it feels like, what is this kind of woo-woo?
Right.
You know, even though I can feel how important it is to my practice, sometimes it's difficult for me to kind of map it onto the rest of Zen. And so I've been thinking about that lately, like what actually is it, you know? And so thank you for that line. It's helpful.
Can I say a word or two about that?
Please.
About metta practice?
Please.
Yeah. So I used to have problems with metta practice. It's like, nothing exists. Why are we asking everyone to be happy? And life is suffering. I did it. And then when I was in the Himalayas, maybe 20 years ago, I suffered a stroke. And I was alone for a while my companion went to get help. And I was pretty helpless there. And I sat there and I said to the mountains, I might die here now. And the mountains, it was like I could hear the mountains say, welcome. Everything dies. And it was very comforting. It really dissolved my fear of death. And then I had this experience, and this is how it relates to metta, of I thought, okay, I'm going to sit zazen. I might die, and I'm going to sit zazen as I die. And I didn't want to. I wanted to sit and offer metta to my surviving family, to all beings. I sat and I did metta practice, and I was disturbed to do that. And I went and I talked to my teacher afterwards, my Zen teacher. I said, I keep doing zazen, and why didn't I do zazen when I felt like I was going to die? And I did metta instead. And he looked at me and says, well, that sounds kind of natural. And actually, my Qigong teacher, her Dharma teaching is just natural. Metta's just natural. It brings us back to just natural, which is so wonderful to discover that.
Thank you so much.
We have a question on Zoom from Anand.
Can you hear me? Thank you for your talk. I love the example of the gong and the not gong. And so holding both ringing and not ringing and practicing and not practicing. Can you say more about that? Like how we do that?
Mm.
How to work with that?
Many ways. The most fundamental way is trust. And find your own ways of doing it, but anchor it. And I find it helpful to anchor in the body. So sometimes I have a lot of medical problems right now and quite a few symptoms. And sometimes I will let myself first feel all those symptoms and then feel my skin and then let myself be aware of all that is not touching my skin and then let the symptoms and those experiences be in the room and feel the walls of the room as my body. It's not an imagination. It's a very concrete experience. And again, speaking neurologically, we know that like this sound that you're hearing right now, is it inside you or outside you? Doesn't make sense to ask that question. Same with pain. People can get pain. You cut off an arm and they have pain in the arm that isn't there. Actually, all the suffering in the world is in that arm that isn't there. And so to just let yourself be aware of what you're not aware of without making it into an object and just knowing that you're not aware and letting it expand and then come back to this dimensionless point and then be puzzled and blink and sneeze and, but anchor in vision, in the way you feel your feet touch the floor, in every thought that you have, think of all the thoughts you're not having. It's really quite fun and limitless. And then the practice is about freedom. Then you're not stuck. I don't know if that helps, but we each have to find our practice, which helps us experience that.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Genko. I had an experience many years ago. When I went to Tassajara for a practice period, I had a lot of trouble with my back, upper back, right around the shoulder blade. And I struggled with it, it gradually got better and whatever, and over the years it's gotten better. But then I had another experience where I listened to a teacher who was doing this kind of big mind thing, and there was an exercise that had something to do with, I don't exactly remember how it went, but it had something to do with watching the energy come up the body. It got right about here and got stuck. And I just sat there being stuck for a while and eventually was able to breathe my way through it. And I left. And at some point I began to realize, oh, the back and the heart are connected.
Yes.
And so that business of being able to see the space in between and to recognize there's something else there really gave me an insight into what was going on. So I appreciate this other way of looking at it because that validates that particular experience of understanding that it's not just the back. It's not just on the surface, which is what we think of. So when we put a hand here and a hand here, those are two different things. Well, they're not. And to start seeing the lines and the connections in between them was very helpful for me and has been one of the many things that has helped me start connecting with everything in here. So I appreciate that.
Thank you. Yes. As someone with fairly severe scoliosis and several injuries, I've had to work with my back and now some other things. The other day I was, every sensation is an opinion.
Is what?
An opinion.
An opinion.
Yes. We don't usually see them that way.
Yeah.
But also they're all connected somatically. So one way of treating back problems is through the ankles and changing your feet and your posture. And using a different sense. So one thing I'll sometimes do with pain is I'll approach the pain through hearing. Not listening, because listening is already, what does this mean? Where is it? Just hear it, like I'd hear a sound, but experience the pain as if it were through that modality is the best way to describe it. And that's very helpful. I will caution folks, I'll just tell you a trap I fell into. So I'm a lineage holder in Qigong now. I teach classes on pain management as a neuropsychologist. I developed programs. And I fell into the trap of thinking, oh, since I can do all these things, I shouldn't experience physical problems. And that was my egotistic version of thinking I was a sage. And I can guarantee you that if you think you're a sage in some area, the universe will find a way of disabusing you of that notion.
I'll keep that in mind and let my friend Sage know that.
I think, how are we doing? One more question? One more question then, okay.
Hi.
Oh, since you're sitting next to each other, let's do two more.
Okay, at the same time, right?
Same time? So,
my name is Daigai, and I've never done any practices where I put hands on my body and felt space in between. It was interesting. But the final gesture you had us do was by gathering compassion. And for many years, I never thought to touch my heart or anything like that. But over the last half dozen or so, that gesture started happening on its own. First with one hand, and then it started to turn into two.
Uh-huh.
And instead of just touching, when I'm in a period of very open-heartedness or just really expansive and loving, I find this is an automatic.
Yes.
It happened all by itself. It's like my body knew that already.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. And all of these techniques and practices that we do help us to that. There's a great saying by Chuang Tzu. Everyone has the mind, Buddha mind, as their teacher, The problem is people think they have to understand it first. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your talk. I want to share a moment. I was sitting recently and I had this experience of big energy coming through and a recognition of, oh, I mean, I know that I went through a lot in my history. Mm-hmm. I know the story, right? But there was this bigger recognition simultaneously of like, oh my God, I was so dissociated. Mm-hmm. And then it was a simultaneous coming out, I think, of dissociation on some level. Like it was like I felt the sort of shock energy. Mm-hmm. And immediately on the heels of that was like, what am I not aware of right now? Mm-hmm. If it took me that long to become aware of how far away I was to come into this moment, then I went to, oh no, what am I not aware of right now? And I had this sort of moment.
I'm going to interrupt you.
Okay.
Not, oh no, what am I not aware of right now, but, oh, good, what am I not aware of right now? How wonderful. Is that okay?
Yes.
Yeah. So what you're describing, my friend Alan Sinake says, has his definition of mindfulness. He says, it's just reassembling the scattered pieces into wholeness. Isn't that a wonderful... Maybe enough for now? Thank you very much. Would you chant now, or do I offer first? Ah, of course.